views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Good evening. This is Onaji Mawid, host of Race Treaty, that comes to you every Friday evening between 9 and 10 Eastern Standard Time. And we are concerned with the presence and the future of African people worldwide, referencing all international covenants, but particularly referencing international covenant to eliminate racism, discrimination, ICER, as it's called. Last week, we started with this journey into commemorating, remembering 1968 and all the things that happened in 1968. And of course, we were at the National Association of Black Social Workers that was held in Washington, D.C. But we're going to add to that discussion something that happened, in fact, a year after 1968. And of course, I'm talking about 1969. And that which I'm giving reference to is what is called the Black Manifesto. The Black Manifesto, some of the audience may have recalled, was a document that really was connected to a movement. And tonight we have on our show someone who was a part of that movement in many different ways. So I'm going to learn some things about this person and his involvement in the things which I don't know. I know a few things, but not that many, and certainly not as much as I need to know. So I would like our guest to introduce himself.
Brother Mwalimu Amani. I was not actually involved in the Black Manifesto's creation. However, I knew principals who were, including James Forman, who I knew from 6-7 years before when I was in SNCC.
But, okay. I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to say that we had a really good relationship. I was basically forced back to New York out of a college in Fayetteville State, North Carolina. And I was forced because a police chief threatened my life. When I went back to New York, what I did was to hook up with Jim Forman. That was in 1963. I had done work prior to that under the auspices of SNCC in 1962 while on campus.
So you were raised in North Carolina?
That's where I grew up in North Carolina and New York, but I finished high school in North Carolina, and between going to a CCNY and taking scholarship down south, I chose to go down south first. I wound up going to finishing all of my college work up north, but I did start in North Carolina.
Okay. And you graduated high school where?
Kinston, North Carolina, Atkin High School. I is one of those schools that actually had its own history. Back in 1951, there was a school walkout that had it played out. Could have been part of Brown versus Board. Students actually walked out to get better conditions for their school, and they were told that maybe in 10 years they could begin to consider that. Well, 2 years later, they were constructing a gymnasium and additional classrooms. That gymnasium, by the way, hosted such folk as the Globetrotters, James Brown, and many other celebrities that you would know if I were to call their names. So that was in 1951. Of course, it was not litigated. Otherwise, it would have been part of the Brown versus Board, which contained cases from South Carolina, Washington, D.C., Delaware, and Topeka, Kansas.
And the year that you graduated high school is?
1960.
1960. Okay. So you knew about this walkout that happened 9 years prior.
I knew about it because I had two siblings who were in the school.
Oh, okay.
But it was one of those situations where they did not talk about it. Even afterwards, it wasn't talked about. It was never mentioned as part of the curriculum. What brought it to the attention of the nation, in fact, was a reenactment of that walkout back in 2010 in Kinston, at which time there was a white reporter who was interested, and he got the Journalism Award of the Year for carrying the story.
And what year was that, Imani?
That was 2010. 2010 was when the reenactment occurred. Yes.
So this is fairly recent.
Well, recent in terms of it coming to national attention.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
That's correct. And let me follow this. In June of 2013, through efforts, because I knew people at the Library of Congress and Smithsonian, I brought it to their attention. And on that day, we were interviewed. And that 2-hour and 33-minute interview is now part of the record in the Smithsonian. Consequently, we were invited to the opening of the National African American Museum in Washington, D.C. in September of 2016.
So how would our listening audience have access to that interview?
The easiest way would be to Google the name John Dudley. That is John and Dudley, D-U-D-L-E-Y, Adkin High School. That is A-D-K-I-N, High School. That's the easiest way to do it.
So this John Dudley, is that you?
No. No, that is not me. John Dudley was the 17-year-old who led the walkout of that school. And it was precipitated, by the way, it was a school announcement that morning, which was a pretense. Someone lost a red pocketbook. And when that announcement was made, all 700 plus students walked out.
Okay, I'm missing something here. So somebody announces, the principal, whoever announces the missing pocketbook, theft or whatever. So why would that cause a student body to organize a strike and walk out?
Well, that was a signal to do it because we had been denied already new facilities. And because students had already met, that was going to be the signal. It was just a signal to, when you hear this, that will be the time to walk out. It was not true. There was no lost pocketbook. It was just a signal to walk out at that time.
Okay.
Subterfuge.
I see. So, I don't know how much detail you know in terms of how long it took them to organize that strike to happen. What did it, was it going on for 30 days, 60 days? Was it 90 days?
It was a matter of days, really. And it was upperclassmen who basically organized it, juniors, seniors. But every class president knew about it and consequently would let their students know. And this high school, by the way, went from 7th grade to 12th. So you had, you know, young people, I mean, very young people participating who may not have known exactly what they were doing.
Wow. Wow. This. So for those of who are just listening in, this is Onajima Wade, co-host of Race Treaty. We have with his brother Imani, and he is sharing, you know, part of his life with us that surrounds the Black Manifesto. But prior to that, we're getting some information about who he is, his family, and his siblings who were part of this strike that happened in 1951 and didn't come to national attention until 2011. So this is I'm just one of those millions who hadn't heard of it either. So this history lesson is quite significant to know of this. And really, we want to highlight the courage of young people, the sacrifices they've made, and how much they are needed in our continuing struggle for self-determination and human rights. So, Brother Imani, thank you so much for that. And we do look forward to do the research to find out more about that particular incident. So as a high school graduate, and you said 1960?
1960, that's correct.
So when you came out of school in 1960 as a high school graduate, what was your thinking? What was going on in your mind at the time?
Well, I had a personal history. I 2 weeks after, well, let me back up. When Emmett Till died, I was in North Carolina. I was an angry young man at that time. I left pretty soon because I always spent my summers in New York or in Camden, New Jersey. So I grew up caddying. And one day I'd taken two bags. I had caddied since I was 9 years old. And this particular day, I took a bus from the golf course all the way home, but I had to transfer in midtown. And when I transferred, the bus went another block or so, and this white woman got on and came to the back. I'm sitting in front of the back door. From the back door on back, it was considered Black territory. Well, I'm sitting in near the window, and a white guy is sitting beside me. The woman comes and stands over us, and she asks for my seat. Now, I'm 12 years old, 13, because I think I was the same age as Emmett Till at the time. So she asked for my seat, and I looked at her and said, no. And she looked at me and said, I'm white. And I was a smart mouth, so I said, and so is toilet paper. So she went back up front, told the bus driver, and the driver, when he made this turn to go toward the Black community, he came in the back and asked me to let the woman sit down in my seat. And I told him no. But before I told him no, there was a chorus of Black men in the back saying, leave that boy alone. As I'm saying no to him, he promptly turns around and goes back. And then he calls the woman, says, maybe I'll find a place for you up front here. So that was my beginning of resistance. There were some others along the way. But as I move forward, 2 weeks after the sit-in at Greensboro, I was at it again. There was a drugstore in Kinston that we were going to integrate by hell or high water. A friend of mine and his brother, we concocted a scheme. I wanted him dressed as an African diplomat, and I would be his interpreter. I spoke French fluently in those days. his brother was going to be a lookout. So we go into this place and order eggs, toast, and a coffee. He looked at us as if we were from Mars. So I said, well, look, Monsieur Curtis is from Ghana, and he needs to be served. So they're thinking he's from the embassy in Washington. So she turns and goes to her manager. The manager comes over, looks stupid, and says, go serve him. So sure enough, they go back and prepare the meal. But out comes a waitress who lives in my building. I lived in the projects. And she nearly dropped her tray when she saw who it was. So she gave the tray to this white waitress who promptly served him. And I stayed there talking to him in Tarzan language, if you will, Monsieur Curtis, until he finished his food and we paid. And as soon as that happened, we ran back to East Kensington as fast as we could. But we had integrated that counter.
And what year was this?
1960, 2 weeks after Greensboro, sit-in at Greensboro. Hmm. In February 1960.
So you were still in high school. This is your senior year in high school.
I was still in high school. Monsieur Curtis, his name was actually Curtis Henderson. He had just graduated the year before. And his brother Tom was a junior. So, but that was something that, as I say, we concocted and wanted to do. And we got away clean with it without being arrested.
Now tell me, when you saw your neighbor the next time after that, what conversation occurred after that?
Well, one of the things that happened during the struggle, I was telling you about the 51 incident. That's something that was not talked about in the community afterwards. This is also something that wasn't talked about in the community. It just wasn't. Some years ago, I published an article in a reunion newspaper so that people knew that it happened. We have to do that. We have to publish so that people know the history.
This is so exciting to learn all these things. So I did find on the web, after searching John Dudley, contributor names of Civil Rights History Project, Emile Crosby, John Dudley, Samuel Dove.
Emile Crosby.
Samuel Dove, James Jorman, Francis Suggs, and Harold Suggs, and Eleanor Stewart. That's the one. Okay. So Samuel Dove, is that you?
That is me. Mwalimu Amani is my nom de guerre.
Now help me understand that French that you just laid on me.
That's my war name.
Okay. All right. So I know that you had scheduled a half an hour with us tonight, given responsibilities that you have, but I do want to invite you back so we can continue this conversation. This is just a warm-up. You know, we haven't gotten to the Black Manifesto yet. This is a warm-up, but in these last couple of minutes, any other things you'd like to mention? Because I want to be respectful of the time and respectful of our agreement.
Well, just on the Black Manifesto, I can tell you this before we go any further, that several of the people who were proposed to be on the steering committee for the manifesto, I know several of them, or I should say I knew several of them, because some are deceased. And I did not participate in this, even though I knew about it. I was in New York when this happened. This actually happened in Detroit under the auspices of BETSE, or we call it BETSE, the Black Economic Development Conference. And several people that, as I said, that I knew, including Foreman, of course, were participants in this conference. Lou Walker, for example, from IFCO, Howard Fuller, who set up Malcolm X Liberation University in Durham, Ken Cockrell, who was an attorney in Detroit, of course, Fannie Lou Hamer and Julian Bond, and of course, Muhammad Kenyatta, who was elected to be the chairman, vice chairman of the steering committee, and Bob Brown, who was an economist who taught at, I believe it was Seton Hall. So I knew a number of these, the people who were principals. And as we say, the $500 million that Foreman asked for, or demanded, if you will, no, we didn't get it, but we got many, many returns from it. And even though some monies did come forth right away in the form of grants to poverty programs, et cetera, but overall, it wasn't just from Christian churches, by the way. It was also from synagogues. And the day that he actually did his deed, which was at Riverside Church in New York, it was just a few days after the conference, because he had made it a call, if you will, to the Black community to do something on that day. In fact, on that day, I was in a Unitarian church on Central Park West, making an appeal to the church folk there to assist the Black community in ways that they had not done before. So the history goes back, my brother.
And yes, and we want to capture that, because history gives us our identity. It gives us power in the moment in terms of giving us our purpose, and that propels us into our future, our direction. So without identity, purpose, and directions, people are lost, and we are not completely lost, but seem to be pretty close to it, because so much of our people do not know our history for all the reasons why it's convenient for those who tend to keep us in these states of ignorance and states of oppression. So I want to thank you, Brother Imani, for this first interview. I know you had a half hour. I want to respect that time and ask you to just be in touch, so we can look at another time where we can continue this this conversation. This is Onaji Muweed with part one of tonight's interview, and we look forward to returning with you after the debate. Thank you so much, Brother Imani.
You're welcome.
Blessings. Peace.
Please. No, I'm not a writer.
Okay.
Black Talk Radio, since 2008, providing new black media for the masses.
This is Onaji Muweed. You just finished listening to Brother Imani speaking to us about this hidden black gold history that most of us have never heard about. It is quite striking, and indeed so valuable to learn of him and beginning to uncover, unravel the things that he's been involved with in his lifetime. We started off this program by referencing this walk that we're taking, this 50-year journey from 1968 to 2018. And last week we featured the National Association of Black Social Workers, that began their journey into their full organizational fullness in terms of 1968 by walking out. And we've continued to look at this 50-year journey, but we took a step forward and looked at what is called the Black Manifesto. It stated, this is done in Detroit. We Black people assembled in Detroit, Michigan, for the National Black Economic Development Conference are fully aware that we have been forced to come together because racist white America has exploited our resources, our minds, our bodies, our labor. For centuries, we have been forced to live as colonized people inside the United States, victimized by the most vicious racist system in the world. We have helped to build the most industrial country in the world. We are therefore demanding of the white Christian churches and Jewish synagogues, which are part and parcel of the system of capitalism, that they begin to pay reparations to Black people in this country. We are demanding $500 million from the Christian white churches and the Jewish synagogues. The total comes to $15 per nigger, and that's the word they use, $15 per nigger. This is a low estimate, for we maintain there are probably more than 300 million Black people in this country. $15 a nigger is not a large sum of money, and we know that the churches and synagogues have a tremendous wealth, and its membership, white America, has profited and still exploits Black people. We are also not unaware that the exploitation of colored peoples around the world is aided and abetted by the white Christian churches and synagogues. The demand for $500 million is not an idle resolution or empty words. $15 for every Black brother and sister in the United States is only a beginning of the reparations due us as a people. Okay, lost my place here. We are also not unaware that the exploitation of colored peoples around the world is aided and abetted by white Christian churches and synagogues. This demand for $500 million is not an idle resolution or empty words. $15 for every Black brother and sister in the United States is only a beginning of the reparations due us as a people who have been exploited and degraded, brutalized, killed, and prosecuted. Underneath all of this exploitation, the racism of this country has produced a psychological effect upon us that we are beginning to shake off. We are no longer afraid to demand our full rights as a people in this decadent society. We are demanding $500 million to be spent in the following way. Number one, we call for the establishment of a Southern land bank to help our brothers and sisters who have to leave their land because of racist pressure for people who want to establish cooperative farms but who have no funds. We have seen too many farmers evicted from their homes because they have dared to defy the white racism of this country. We need money for land. We must fight for massive sums of money for the Southern Land Bank. We call for $200 million to implement this program. Number two, we call for the establishment of four major publishing and printing industries in the United States to be funded with $10 million each. These publishing houses are to be located in Detroit, Atlanta, Los Angeles, and New York. They will help to generate capital for further cooperative investments in the Black community, provide jobs, and an alternative to white-dominated and controlled printing field. Three, we call for the establishment of four of the most advanced scientific and futuristic audio-visual networks to be located in Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, and Washington, D.C. These TV networks will provide an alternative to the racist propaganda that fills the current television networks. Each of these TV networks will be funded by $10 million each. Number four, We call for a research skills center, which will provide research on the problems of Black people. This center must be funded with no less than $30 million. Number five, we call for the establishment of a training center for the teaching of skills in community organization, photography, movie making, television making and repair, radio building and repair, and all other skills needed in communications. This training center shall be funded with no less than $10 million. Number six, we recognize the role of the National Welfare Rights Organization, and we intend to work with them. We call for $10 million to assist in the organization of welfare recipients. We want to organize the welfare workers in this country so that they may demand more money from the government and better administration of the welfare system of this country. Number seven, we call for $20 million to establish a national Black labor strike and defense fund. This is necessary for the protection of Black workers and their families who are fighting racist working conditions in this country. We call for the establishment of the International Black Appeal, IBA. This International Black Appeal will be funded with no less than $20 million. The IBA is charged with producing more capital for the establishment of cooperative businesses in the United States and in Africa, our motherland. The International Black Appeal is one of the most important demands that we are making, for we know that it can generate and raise funds throughout the United States and help our African brothers. The IBA is charged with three functions and shall be headed by James Foreman. A, raising money for the program of the National Black Economic Conference. B, the development of cooperatives in African countries and support African liberation movements. And C, establishment of a Black Anti-Defamation League, which will protect our African image. And under that, one, we call for the establishment of a Black university to be funded with $130 million to be located in the South. Negotiations are presently underway with a Southern university. Two, we demand that IFCO allocate all unused funds in the planning budget to implement the demands of this conference. In order to win our demands, we are aware that we will have to have a massive support. Therefore, we will enumerate the following. One, we call upon all Black people throughout the United States to consider themselves as members of the National Black Economic Development Conference and to act in unity to help force the racist white Christian churches and Jewish synagogues to implement these demands. Two, we call upon all the concerned Black people across the country to contact Black workers, Black women, Black students, and Black unemployed community groups, welfare organizations, teacher organizations, church leaders and organizations, explaining how these demands are vital to the Black community of the United States. Pressure by whatever means necessary should be applied to the white power structure of the racist white Christian churches and Jewish synagogues. All Black people should act boldly in confronting our white oppressors and demanding this modest reparation of $15 per Black man. Three, delegates and members of the National Black Economic Development Conference are urged to call press conferences in the cities and to attempt to get as many Black organizations as possible to support the demands of the conference. The quick use of the press in the local areas will heighten the tension, and these demands must be attempted to be won in a short period of time, although we are prepared for protracted and long-range struggle. The Black Manifesto, emanating from the National Black Economic Conference in Detroit on this date, April the 26th, 1969. No, it's not in the year of 1968 that we'll be focusing on for the next couple of programs, but it was such an important part, since it happened in the month of April, to not let it go by. So often our people have struggled And the memory of that struggle is left in the past, and we cannot do that. We must affirm the principle of Sankofa to go back and fetch it, to get what you lost and bring it forward and use it in your life today. Our people are in the process of Sankofa, moving, using, remember, Ani's paradigm that we were in, Ma'at, in truth, we moved away from it. Then we went through resurgence in terms of Sankofa. Then we gained Ma'at again, and we lost it, and we went in these circles, gaining, losing, gaining, losing, gaining, losing. And of course, it was interrupted by the Ma'afa that has still plagued us for over 500 years and still is plaguing us. But the Sankofa has started. We are returning to ourselves, to our identity, to our purpose, to our direction. We are returning to this mission of liberation and self-determination. And in that returning, we are retrieving our history as we are now looking at the Black Manifesto. Brother Imani was on the first part of this program tonight, and we'll have others join us, certainly to have him back when his time permits. But certainly all of us, I'm sure, was learning about John Dudley and the struggle that the high school students, listen now, the high school students in 1951, which just happens to be a year before I was born, right? The students at North Carolina, Atkin High School, there in Kingston, North Carolina, decided to walk out because of how unequal, separate and equal, no, separate and unequal, how they were protesting the facilities in which they were housed. And 2 years later, they won that battle in terms of having a new building. So how many of us knew about that? So we have to continue to pass down our history, both our victories and our defeats. But as long as we struggle, we are winning, because that's how people move their people forward, is by the continuation of the struggle. It's not an event. It is a process. It's one that's going to take many events tied to many other events to, in fact, move to the ultimate victory of our struggle. So we are looking at this 50-year period of 1968 to 2018. We took a little left turn, but it's certainly in the conversation, because from 1968 forward, right, 1969 would be the next year. So you can see how 1968 had to be a springboard for what happened in 1969, particularly the Black Manifesto. And as we will bring forward guests who were involved with it directly or indirectly, they will help us see the link between 1968 and the Black Manifesto that happened in 1969. For those of you who didn't hear first part of the interview with Brother Imani, he mentioned there was a steering committee, Lucius Walker, Howard Fuller, who else? Fannie Lou Hamer, in fact, Muhammad Kenyatta, Bob Brown, and there was another person who you had mentioned, Ken, who I didn't get the full name, who I didn't know much about. So this is our history. These are the battles we have fought. These are the battles we continue to fight. And as we continue to fight for these battles, we shall be victorious. My mentor, Irvin Davis, says, promoted to Jacinda, together we will win only if we continue to struggle. And that's what we are here doing at Race Treaty, that comes to you every Friday evening at 9 Eastern Standard Time. And we will continue with this conversation as well. Thank you very much.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
This is Onaji Muid, continuing the discussion on the Black Manifesto. we had ended with, we call upon all the delegates and members of the National Black Economic Development Conference to stage sit-in demonstrations as selected black and white churches. This is not to be interrupted or interpreted as a continuation of the sit-in movement of the early 60s, but we know that active confrontation inside white churches is possible and will strengthen the possibility of meeting our demands. Such confrontation shall take the form of reading the Black Manifesto instead of a sermon or passing it out to church members. The principles of self-defense shall be applied if attacked. On May 4th, 1969, or date thereafter, depending upon local conditions, we call upon black people to commence the disruption of the races, churches, and synagogues throughout the United States. We call upon IFCO to serve as a central staff to coordinate the mandate of the conference and to reproduce and distribute en masse literature, leaflets, news items, press releases, and other material. We call upon all delegates to find within the white community those forces which will work under the leadership of blacks to implement these demands by whatever means necessary. By taking such actions, white Americans will demonstrate concretely that they are willing to fight the white skin privilege and white supremacy and racism which has forced us as black people to make these demands. This is 9. We call upon all white Christians and Jews to practice patience, tolerance, understanding, and nonviolence as they have encouraged, advised, and demanded that we as black people should do throughout our entire enforced slavery in the United States. The true test of their faith and belief in the cross and the words of the prophets will certainly be put to the test as we seek legitimate and extremely modest reparations for our role in developing the industrial base of the Western world throughout our slave labor. We are no longer slaves. We are men and women, proud of our African heritage, determined to have our dignity. 10. We are so proud of our African heritage and realize concretely that our struggle is not only to make revolution in the United States, but to protect our brothers and sisters in Africa and to help them rid themselves of racism, capitalism, and imperialism by whatever means necessary, including armed struggle. We are and must be willing to fight the deformation of our African image wherever it rears its ugly head. We are therefore charging the steering committee to create a Black Anti-Defamation League to be funded by money raised from the International Black Appeal. 11, we fully recognize that revolution in the United States and Africa, our motherland, is more than one-dimensional operation. It will require the total integration of the political, economic, and military components, and therefore we call upon our brothers and sisters who have acquired training and expertise in the fields of engineering, electronics, research, community organization, physics, biology, chemistry, mathematics, medicine, military science, and warfare to assist the National Black Economic Development Conference in the implementation of its program. 12. To implement these demands, we must make a fearless leadership. We must have a fearless leadership. We must have a leadership which is willing to battle the church establishment to implement these demands. To win our demands, we will have to declare war on the white Christian churches and synagogues, and this means we may have to fight the government structure of this country. Let no one here think that these demands will be met by mere stating them. For the sake of the churches and synagogues, we hope that they have the wisdom to understand that these demands are modest and reasonable. But if the white Christians and Jews are not willing to meet our demands through peace and goodwill, then we declare war and we are prepared to fight by any means necessary. Brothers and sisters, we no longer are shuffling our feet and scratching our heads. We are tall, black, and proud. And we say to the white Christian churches and Jewish synagogues, to the government, to the government of this country, and to all the white racist imperialists who comprise it. There is only one thing left that we can do to further degrade black people, and that is to kill us. But we have been dying too long for this country. We have died in every war. We are dying in Vietnam today, fighting the wrong enemy. The new black man wants to live, and to live means that we must not become static or merely believe in self-defense. We must boldly go out and attack the white Western world at its power centers. The white Christian churches are another form of government in this country, and they are used by the government of this country to exploit the people of Latin America, Asia, and Africa. But the day is soon coming to an end. Therefore, brothers and sisters, demand we make upon the white Christian churches and the Jewish synagogues are small demands. They represent $15 per black person in the United States. We can legitimately demand this from the church power structure. We must demand more from the United States government. But to win our demands from the church, which is linked up with the United States government, we must not forget that it will ultimately be force and power that will win. We are not threatening the churches. We are saying that we know the churches came with the military might of the colonizers and have been sanctioned by the military might of the colonizers. Hence, if the churches in colonial territories were established by military might, we know deep within our hearts that we must be prepared to use force to get our demands. We are not saying that this is the road we want to take. It is not. But let us be very clear that we are not opposed to force and we are not opposed to violence. We were captured in Africa by violence. We were kept in bondage and political servitude and forced to work as slaves by military machinery and the Christian church working hand in hand. We recognize that in issuing this manifesto, we must prepare for a long-range educational campaign in our communities of this country. But we know that the Christian churches have contributed to our oppression in white America. We do not intend to abuse our black brothers and sisters in black churches who have uncritically accepted Christianity. We want them to understand how the racist white Christian church, with its hypocritical declarations and doctrines of brotherhood, has abused our trust and faith. An attack on the religious beliefs of black people is not our major objective. Even though we know that we were not Christians, we were brought to this country, but that Christianity was used to help enslave us. Our objective in issuing this manifesto was to force the racist white Christian churches to begin the payment of reparations which are due to all black people, not only by the church, but also by private business and the United States government. We see this focus on the Christian church as an effort around which all black people can unite. Our demands are negotiable, but they cannot be minimized. They only can be increased. And the church is asked to come up with large sums of money that we are asking. Our slogans are, all roads must lead to revolution. Unite with whomever you can unite. Neutralize wherever possible. Fight our enemies relentlessly. Victory to the people. Life and good health to mankind. Resistance to domination by white Christian churches and the Jewish synagogues. Revolutionary Black Power. We shall win without a doubt. Excerpts from the Black Manifesto. It's black and white. The Reverend Mr. Robert C. Chapman, Director of Racial Justice, the National Council of Churches. One of the causes of concern among black churchmen within the white dominations is the fact that although many of them individually and through corporate structures, have evinced strong support for the principles and demands of Black Manifesto. Their white peers within their own denominations tend to be either heedless or contemptuous of the positions of the Black counterparts. The white brethren openly or by influence make it quite clear that they never nor shall relate in positive way to Mr. Foreman or the BEDC. The whites have tried to freeze it out of existence by extricating its rhetoric. The blacks have made it clear that the rhetoric could not concern them less because the principles and demands speak to a just reordering of priorities and power. The whites tend to be adamantly opposed to the tactics spoken of in the manifesto, but the blacks who have had their churches bombed on Sundays in America and who have had Detroit police officers turn a black church into a sieve while black women and children were inside cannot get terribly excited about the threatened disruption of a worship service in a white church. This mentality, of course, white churchmen are hard-pressed to understand, but then we blacks have never murdered their children by bombing their churches on a Sunday morning. Neither have we fired volley upon volley of bullets into any of their churches, whether or not their women and children were inside. What white brethren must yet understand is that every drop of black blood extracted by a slave master's whip outweighs the present corporate wealth of America. Those myriad drops, those cascading rivers of blood, have saturated our culture, and the damn spots won't out until repentance brings reparations and reparations works full restitution. National Committee of Black Churchmen has said, we raise the salute, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, which sponsored the National Black Economic Black Conference, which in turn became the channel through which James Foreman could appear as a modern-day prophet to speak to the churches. We are mindful that the program proposed has troubled the waters of Ceylon, yet we know that however much the churches may shake to the vibrations of its own cleansing, the healing Christ is working upon them. It is not yet clear how or what degree the manifesto event shall work to pull together the thinking and the acting of the black churchmen, particularly those who witness in predominantly white denominations. It is certain, however, that they cannot be at ease in churches which may ultimately choose to exalt past glories or which would continue to dictate to blacks the leadership and models of behaviors they must accept and emulate. In the cards, therefore, is a grave possibility of a fast increasing gap between black and white churchmen of the same denomination. It is not infrequently today the blacks can hear other blacks project the possibility of having ultimately to withdraw from their denominations, affiliations. This would be a tragedy for black and for white churchmen. Yet the days are now limited in which the churches may continue to talk of reordering priorities and power. Very soon they must do it. If not, their brethren, their black brethren, shall finally be forced into such an unattainable position, title, and membership, but negligible authority that they shall be unable to face with good conscience their suffering black brothers. Let us not err. The burden of responsibility for change is now squarely upon and unequivocally upon the white churches and the white churchmen everywhere. The Black Manifesto can either be positively interpreted and implemented, thus becoming a boon to the churches, or can be rationalized to death and condemned on the basis of its language of impatience, thus becoming a stumbling block of macroscopic proportions. So these are some of the words that was connected to this major event in the history of the United States, where black men and women decided to stand up, not to ask, not to beg, but to demand their reparations for the centuries of terror, of murder, of mayhem, of humiliation, of degradation that was forced upon them by the colonizers who stole the land from the Indians and stole their lives and labor in terms of slave enslavement process that continues today. Even the 13th Amendment that people think abolished slavery did not. It just transformed into another form. It said that slavery, no involuntary servitude shall exist or shall be abolished. Then they say the word what? You know what they say. We have a very educated audience. They say the word except, and except the punishment of a crime. So there's not any reason to doubt that the numbers of black bodies languishing in jails and languishing in prisons and languishing in parole systems are not by accident. It's by design to maintain power and control and exploitation for the furniture that's made in prisons, for the telephone services, for the perfumes. I mean, I don't think there's anything not touched by the exploitation of black bodies, black intelligence, black minds in the prison industrial complex that this country continues to benefit from. And sadly to say that many black people aren't participating in that because they're looking for bargains and not really researching where these bargains are coming from. So this is the struggle for reparation continues. This struggle for self-determination continues. This struggle for human life continues. And we will continue to advocate and communicate for same on race treaty. So you've heard three parts tonight on this introduction to the Black Manifesto that was actually pronounced on April the 26th, 1969. In Detroit. The first part of the program, we had a guest, Brother Imani, who gave us a history of, wow, what happened in Najim Weed, co-host of Race Treaty, saying that we had three parts to the program tonight. The guest was Imani, Brother Imani out of Maryland, who gave us his history of what happened to him as a teenager growing up in North Carolina in 1951, when in fact there was a strike that was led by John Dudley in Atkins High School. 1951, right? 1951. I can imagine just what it must have meant in terms of the level of white supremacy and their insistence in making us submit and the ways in which they had gone about it. I could just only imagine. But they were brave enough to wage a student strike. And that even though it was silenced, it was still nonetheless an event that happened that was still in the memory of the people. And then how Imani spoke about his own awakening, being on the bus and being asked to leave the seat, to give the seat to a white woman. And she proclaimed, "I'm white." You know what that meant. He said, "Well, so is toilet paper," which was certainly true. And white toilet paper is white too. And how the adults on the boat said, "Leave the boy alone." So we've never heard that story before, I'm sure. Part two was my reading of the manifesto. And the source I had didn't have all of the points, and which led to part three, which was the actual continuation of the reading, and also some comments from other black clergymen who was a part of that time and part of that movement in their comments, if nothing more. So we will have other guests to further illuminate us about this time, about this document, and tie the relevance of the document to the different movements that's taking place now, Black Lives Matters, and COBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations America, how it's tied to ICRAM, International Human Rights for American Minorities, all these different movements, and certainly the Republic of New Africa. So we will be making those ties, those connections, and strengthening our organization, organizing, but keeping in mind, as Ella Baker said, that I didn't come here to build an organization. I came here to build a movement. This is Onaji Muweed thanking you for listening in, thanking you for spreading the word, and thanking you for joining in for the future shows on race treaty. Have a very good night.